Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty is away this week, and thanks to the magic of radio production, Adam Ragusea begins this next segment in search of one of this state's great natural resources.
So, if you're like me, despite the fact that you live in one of America's major coastal cities, you can sometimes go like 6 months without seeing the actual coast. Until one day you just get in the car, and you drive down 93 and 93 to 3 over the Sagamore Bridge, you get on Route 6, drive, and eventually you hang a right onto some little road, and you go until you can't go anymore. And you pull into some parking lot, climb out of the car, and you walk toward some shrubby green stuff that you can't see beyond, and under your feet, pavement turns to wood, turns to sand, and all of a sudden you're at the edge of a bluff, and my God, it's the ocean! Both directions, as far as you can see, nothing but sand and ocean, and that's it.
Hey Adam, sounds beautiful out there. I know it is, but sadly, I got to pull you back into the studio here in Boston. But it's nice to know this place we're hearing in the background there is only a couple hours away.
It's true. The Cape Cod National Seashore, it's quite a place, and we're talking about it today because 50 years ago this weekend, that just endless beach and those miles of rolling dunes, they were all established as a national park by President John F. Kennedy. And when I was down there recently, I spoke with the park historian Bill Burke. And he told me that the original idea for the National Seashore was even bigger than what we ended up with.
There was a proposal to actually create a National Seashore that stretched from Quincy all along the inside of the arm of the Cape up to Provincetown. And it was estimated $10 an acre, 30,000 acre seashore all along South Shore, Cape Cod, Provincetown.
Well, Adam, so the original idea would have been to make the entire South Shore and the inside of the Cape all the way up to Provincetown,
yeah,
the national park. So what happened?
Well, that was the idea back in the 20s and 30s. But then, of course, the Depression happened, followed by World War II. And the idea just kind of got shelved until the 50s. And then there was this huge post-war building boom on the South Shore and the Cape. And so the federal government started looking at the Atlantic seacoast of the Outer Cape. So here's Bill Burke again.
The two senators that were heavily involved in the 50s were Kennedy and Saltonstall, and they were both very supportive of the concept beginning in about 56, 57. And, you know, then Kennedy wins the election in 60, and the bill is still being debated, and he's president, and this isn't really documented strongly, but he had a lot of influence once he was president. All of his colleagues in the Senate and the House knew that this would please him greatly if they could push, you know, finally push through the legislation.
And then August 7, 1961, 50 years ago this weekend, Kennedy signs the National Seashore Act, and some 43,000 acres, basically all of the Atlantic seacoast of the Outer Cape, is protected forever.
And listeners, this is what we're going to be talking about today. We're celebrating the birthday of the Cape Cod National Seashore. Does your family visit that park? What memories or favorite spots can you share with us? And here's a provocative question. Do you think in today's political climate, the federal government could come in and rope off thousands of prime beachfront acres from development? What do you think? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK.
And there was, of course, significant local opposition to the park 50 years ago. And that impacted the way the Seashore Bill was written and how it's been managed ever since. So joining us to talk about that from a studio in Northeast Am is George Price, superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore. How you doing, George?
Fine. How are you?
Marvelous. And also with you there is Dana Eldridge, who is a 13th generation Cape Codder, the author of some wonderful books about growing up on the Cape and now a part-time ranger with the park. Dana Eldridge, thank you for being there with us.
It's a pleasure.
Now, Dana, you had family members who were opposed to the National Seashore, right?
I certainly did. My uncle.
Yeah, go ahead.
Very opposed.
Your uncle was opposed.
Right.
Why was he opposed?
He was a pretty insular man. Most of the Cape Towns are insular. And he just saw it as something different. And I think people in general are frightened of change.
And I suppose there was a fear of economic consequences that it could, you know, that by preventing development, that could hurt the long-term economy of the Cape.
I think that was a factor.
Yeah. George, how many people were living in the area of the seashore back then, and who owned all that land?
Well, the population was obviously much, much less than what we have today, but the land was generally either private land, town-owned land. There were some tracts that were federal. Camp Wellfleet was a military facility. The state owned the province lands, which was in public ownership since the colonial periods. The Plymouth Colony actually had the province land set aside in the 1630s. But largely it was this mosaic. The overwhelming majority would be private.
And how many people had houses on the seashore?
Well, thousands still.
No.
As a matter of fact, since the seashore was established, there's been over 2,000 land transactions.
Oh, wow.
And in the seashore currently, we still have 600 private homes and residents. So you can see that there were quite a few people here, which was the challenge on the federal side to create a national park. Because as you said in your intro, can you imagine trying to do it today?
Sure.
And when national parks were first established, 1872 being the first one at Yellowstone, they were still just territory. So it was easier to do there. And then there was a model of it was either previous federal land or it was donated land through families or business people.
Well, still, there were examples of national parks, correct me if I'm wrong, where there was, you know, there were inhabitants of the land. I guess in the case of Yosemite, there were ranchers who were opposed to it. In the case of Shenandoah, there were some mountain families who lived there who had to be moved off the land, right?
Well, that's correct. And the use of eminent domain was the way that was accomplished. I think the big difference was that here you had six communities that have been towns and active facilities for 300 and 400 years already. Out in the Yosemite Valley, there may have been some individual folks there, but largely that was either federal or state land already. So, and that would be different from then, say, neighbors that were in opposition. Even when Rockefeller purchased and then presented the Grand Tetons to the federal government as a national park, certainly a lot of the local ranchers, and some of them of quite famous notoriety, some movie stars, were in firm opposition to that being taken and turned into a federal reserve.
Well, in the case of the Cape Cod National Seashore, ultimately, the solution that was devised to handle the people who were already living there came to be known as the Cape Cod model. What is the Cape Cod model?
Well, for its day, it was really a unique way to approach this. And I have to give a lot of credit to the staff of Senator Stalton Stahl and Senator Kennedy. They were the ones that really worked with a lot of the people in the local community, boards of selectmen, planning board, the realtors, to try to identify how this could be accomplished. And there were a number of elements which really were unique to national parks at the time. To have these large areas of private property within the boundary of the seashore, for example. So out of the 44,000 acres that are located in the boundary, the federal government only owns 27,000 of those acres in fee ownership, and some of that is actually submerged lands. So obviously everything else is all other. So in large tracts of East Ham, Wellfleet, and Truro, for example, those are properties that are private property, and the development of that area is supposed to be managed through zoning language that's agreed to by the town and the Secretary of the Interior. The establishment of the advisory commission that would have direct town, state, county input into advice to the superintendent and the Secretary of the Interior on park development issues. The fact that they allowed the existing commercial businesses to stay just prevented any new commercial businesses from coming in. And these were all things, I think, that took some of the angst out of the concern from some of the local people.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the people who had built before, was it 1958?
September 1st, 1959 was the cutoff that was listed in the legislation.
Okay, so those folks are allowed to stay in perpetuity and sell their homes and what have you. But then there's these people who built in between 1959 and when Kennedy signed the legislation in 1961, and their status is a little bit different, right?
Well, that's true. And it isn't just a structure that was there prior to 59. You had to actually prove that you owned an improved property and that you owned the property and the underlying ground that, the structure was on prior to September 1st, 1959.
Okay.
So in some cases, when the land lawyers and the land officials got involved and examined every individual plot, in many cases it went to court, that actually was the standard that had to be put in place. And then you would be eligible for what's called a certificate of suspension of condemnation. So if you could not prove those elements, then you were not eligible for that, and therefore the federal government would be able to take your property, or at least you would not be able to demonstrate in the future that you had a total clear title.
It's all very potentially very sticky stuff when you're talking about government coming in and potentially taking away private property to meet a public good. I'm curious, Dana Eldridge, do any Cape Codders still think that the National Seashore today was a bad idea?
If there are, they don't talk to me. They know I work for the Park Service. But I'm sure there are some. There are always holdouts for what I think is the common good. My folks were very much for the park. And as I came along, I was also for the park a great deal. I tried to get a job here initially.
Well, when I'm down there, though, I see all these guys with the tourist go home bumper stickers.
No, you don't.
No, I don't.
No.
So the sentiment's got to remain to some degree, right?
I think so. But these are people that I think are, piping plovers taste like chicken people.
Gotcha.
They really don't believe what they're saying. They just want to be part of a group that maybe is popular among their friends.
I see.
I think most people embrace the park with open arms.
And I think, Adam, there's another aspect of this. There certainly was a number of camps initially that voiced opposition, and some of them had to do with the point you brought up about taking private property and turning it to the public good. And there was an article that Kurt Vonnegut actually wrote that talks about some people saying that this is verges on communism. Mm. I mean, what's going on here? You had other people that were concerned about a national park development bringing in too many tourists. And then you had other people that were just concerned. Maybe these were Dana's relatives who said, we don't need the federal government come in here telling us what's important. So you had those types of camps. But then you had others that wanted the federal government, especially the national park system that was familiar with running these types of places, to come in and actually help and provide a realm of protection over these resources. Because if they were allowed to be developed – today we would have the Jersey Shore or Ocean City, Maryland, or some of these other places who chose to manage their facilities differently. So even the critics I hear from and there's another issue, by the way, and that is not only the people initially, but then there's those that might disagree with park management
over
the last 50 years.
Well, we'll get into that. We'll get into that a little bit, George. Sure. But let me just mention that we've got people on Facebook right here kind of echoing that sentiment. So here's Dana Franchito saying, I live within walking distance of the seashore. JFK's vision restored my faith in the potential of good government. If it weren't for the seashore, only a few privileged people would have access to these beautiful beaches. Otherwise, they would have been butchered into suburban developments. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Cape Cod National Seashore. Folks, if you go there, if you take your family there, we'd love to hear about what the park means to you, what you like to do there. Curious about this question about whether or not you think that it would be feasible for this kind of a federal land grab to fly today. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Tom is calling from Waltham. Hey, Tom.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. So you go down to the Cape sometimes?
Yeah, actually, I grew up in Waltham with a pool in the backyard, and my couple of experiences as a kid going down to the Cape, where just the crowded, stuffy long waits at the bridge to get down there, not really sure what all the fuss was about, and then when I started dating my now wife, her family has a place down in Wellfleet, and, you know, I was just utterly amazed at the difference of that portion of the Cape compared to what I had experienced when I was younger, and I just think that, you know, that land is precious, and I do not believe that the federal government could do anything like that today.
All right, Tom, I appreciate your call. Thanks so much. Here's Nancy Jo Craig Rogner talking to us on Facebook. She said, if I wanted cheesy beaches filled with touristy things, I'd spend my summer vacation in New Jersey. This summer, we spent time at Head of the Meadow, and it was pristine with perfect panoramic views of the ocean and beach. There was something magical about sitting there knowing that I was enjoying the same view that someone did 50 years ago. George Price, superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore, let's talk about what some of those sticking points have been with management of the park for you and your predecessors over these last 50 years. Let's start by talking about the dune shacks. For those who don't know, what are dune shacks?
These are a number of literally shacks that were put together over time up in the Province Lands area of the seashore. So the parabolic dunes up there, remember I mentioned before that the Province Lands has been a common area since the days of the Pilgrims. And over time, either folks associated with the life-saving service in the late 19th century or fishermen or family that felt downtown Provincetown was too crowded at that turn of the century built these shacks literally out of driftwood and pieces from the wrecks and or from the life-saving stations. And over the early part of the last century, a number of artists actually migrated out in the dunes. They thought it was a good place to be and to gain some inspiration. Eugene O'Neill is probably the best known at that era who went out there early in his playwriting time. He came up to Provincetown every summer as part of the Provincetown Players. And then he and his colleagues would go back to Manhattan and continue their craft. So obviously he came on to gain a lot of notoriety. Since that time, it really was a collection, in some cases, of artists and writers. There were others that were out there. There was a local poet named Harry Kemp. And then there were other families that just went there for the solitude and a good place to stay for the summer. When the state was involved in it, there was issues over ownership and who actually owned these facilities. When the seashore came in, the land people went through and did the same type of criteria that I mentioned as to whether something would be allowed to stay or not, and there was actually only one family that was able to prove the criteria. So that became quite contentious over time. At this point, a lot of those reservations are what we call expiring, so people might have cut a deal where they had lifetime residency or they had 30 years or 25 years. So the properties have been gradually coming over to seashore management, and the question now is what to do in the future. And there was some thought at one point, certainly in the 80s, that as these terms expired, then the Park Service would actually demolish the structure and therefore restore the dune to its natural beauty. Others thought that was a mistake, and they came forward and actually filed a petition to be having them listed on the National Register. And once something is determined to be eligible, then we're required as a federal agency to protect it and then to determine its usefulness in the future and how it can be maintained. So since that time, it's continued to be quite controversial locally as to how they'll be maintained. What about the families that had been there initially? What about the folks that really care about it? How can we maintain these in the future? And in the last couple of years, we've had a pretty successful subcommittee effort by our advisory commission that has had members of long-term dune shack families, of the towns of Provincetown and Truro, of representatives of our commission and the Friends of Cape Cod National Seashore, and even the one commercial business that's out there. And through an environmental assessment process, we've now developed a preservation and use plan, which outlines really the future of what we believe will be a successful way to preserve them.
And just briefly,
but
George,
that is not universally accepted.
And just briefly, George, essentially it's a plan to allow some people to apply for temporary residency of some of the shacks, right?
Well, it's a lease program.
Okay.
So it's divided up into a long-term, say 20-year lease, a short-term, say 3 to 10-year, and then a number of them, about 40%, to be managed by two nonprofits which currently manage them, which allow for more of a short-term stay, say a week or two. And so it's really a mix and match. And Adam, I have to do one more thing, by the way.
Sure.
I don't know if you knew that I'm from New Jersey. So when we talk about the Jersey Shore, that's where I grew up.
Sorry, George.
Well, it's, again, Atlantic City and these places are historic uses of how some people define to use the shore. And New Jersey has even a national park unit with Sandy Hook, which is part of Gateway, which keeps things wide open just like we do.
Let's go back to some of our callers. Peter is calling from Milton. And Peter, your grandfather owned some property that was taken for the National Seashore?
Yes, he did. He retained the house, but a number of acres around his house was taken, and he was adamantly opposed to it. At the time, didn't want the federal government meddling, but he had friends who had land that was not taken by the seashore that ultimately got developed, and he came around to see the wisdom of preserving the open space. And so while it's a shame that's not still in the family, he realized that it was a good thing.
That's interesting. Can you think of any kind of particular moment or any what was it that turned him around? Because that's got to be tough to see your property go away.
Well, I think it was a number of years later that this adjoining properties that were not taken by the seashore were ultimately, I think, upon the death of the owners, the families then sold out and they got developed.
Yeah.
And that made him realize that nothing is forever if it's left in private hands. Anything can happen to it.
Appreciate the phone call, Peter. Let's go to Daryl, who's calling from Belmont. And Daryl, you were a commercial fisherman.
I was a commercial fisherman on Martha's Vineyard and on the Cape. And I really appreciate the topic today, and your experts have been great. One of the concerns that I had, even as I was working as a commercial fisherman, was that the information about what constitutes public land in the case of the seashore here, what is actually covered. Some of the territory, as one of your experts mentioned, that we're talking about is actually submerged. It's, below the tide line. And it was actually difficult for me, while I was employed as a fisherman, to even find information about this. It was almost impossible to get definitive answers about, what was being covered. And so I wondered if there was any comment about that might clarify why that is, and if there's anything that can be done about that.
Okay, Daryl, I appreciate it. George, that's a pretty specific question. So if you want to give him a very brief answer, go ahead.
Well, basically, the national seashore boundary is a quarter mile off the beach.
Right.
And so that's our jurisdiction. So it is pretty straightforward. If you were down towards Monomoy, the National Wildlife Refuge has some coastline there as well, and that's a different setup, and that's more longitude and latitude. But then basically the rest of the waters up to 3 miles is then managed by the state, so it would be up to their jurisdiction in that area.
Okay, thanks for that, George. Let's go to Nancy, who's calling from Arlington. Nancy, it looks like you go down to the Cape all the time.
I do. I do go down to the Cape all the time, and I feel incredibly grateful that we have this land. I go there any season, and I, for people who don't go to the Cape, I hate to advertise that it's such a great place to go because, I mean, it's still the most pristine spot. It's just beautiful, and I have to say, I've known Dana, my husband Bob, and I used to go down. Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm good.
We used to go down and stay at Dana's place, actually, for years and years, and Dana introduced us to a lot of things about the Cape that we didn't know and a lot of the wildlife there. And I know lots of people visit the National Seashore and take his canoe trips. And, it's just a fabulous place to go. And it's great to go off season when there aren't a lot of crowds. And I'm just so grateful that we have this land and that it's not all developed and that it doesn't look like, shopping malls. So
yeah, let's stop picking on New Jersey. We won't go there. Nancy, but thank you for your phone call. I think that's Nancy's call, Dana and George, speaks to something, which is that the resource that we're talking about with the Cape Cod National Seashore is not just the land, but it's also the rangers and all the wonderful work that you guys do. Just in the last minute that we have here, George Price, I wanted you to speak to something, which is that there's a built-in tension in the National Park Service between preservation and use, and some would say those are two contradictory missions of the Park Service. I'm just curious how you see the balance evolving on the National Seashore with that regard over the next 50 years.
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and my statement now is we're here to celebrate the 50 years, but we are concerned about the future. So what's it going to look like 50 years from now? So I think the managers and the people in the town and the people that support the seashore are going to have to take a look at these questions as things evolve. Obviously, we're going to be facing things like climate change and sea level rise, the changing demographics of the communities and therefore the pressures from the communities, the different expectations of visitors and the visiting public, and our responsibility towards the protection, for instance, of the exotic species or the endangered species. Mm-hmm. So it certainly is a challenge, and you're right. The preservation versus use is a challenge that was put forth in 1916 when the National Park Service was established, and it's something that we deal with all the time. One of the things your caller said, by the way, was about the overall significance about the seashore. When the seashore was signed into law, the Berkshire Eagle said this was the finest victory ever recorded for the cause of conservation in New England. And I think that's still true today, and it's something that we can all appreciate, this gift that was given to us back when President Kennedy signed the law.
That's fantastic. George Price is the superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore. Dana Eldridge is a part-time ranger with the seashore. He's also an author of books about growing up as a 13th generation Cape Codder, including Once Upon a Cape Cod and Cape Cod Lucky. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
If you're interested in hearing more of the history of the National Seashore, we have a terrific slideshow at RadioBoston.org narrated by park historian Bill Burke. Also, one thing that we didn't talk about too much today was the impact of coastal erosion and climate change and what they're having on the National Seashore. And that's a very, very big issue that we're going to take up on tomorrow's show. But for the time being, up next after a break, your weekend arts picks around Boston and documentary filmmaker Sebastian Younger. Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusea with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.